It's been said that we are only one generation away from our loss of faith. And certainly faith is something that can be passed along, at least in some aspects. The atheistic philosopher Bertrand Russell was once asked, "If you meet God after you die, what will you say to him to justify your unbelief?" His answer, "God, you did not give me enough evidence on which to believe." Bertrand Russell did not understand the concept of faith as I find it in scriptures. Russell was a hostile voice against Christianity, but I will admit that his desire for evidence or proof is not unique, nor do I think it's necessarily inappropriate. The search for evidence of God and a basis of our faith is not in and of itself wrong, but rather, I think, in and of itself natural. Several passages I could reference, but I just cite the little book of Habakkuk, 3 chapters. Habakkuk was asking God questions, why? Why have you done this? And I find it interesting that God never chastised or rebuked Habakkuk, because I assume Habakkuk's questions were honest and sincere rather than manipulative. And I don't think God will chastise us when our questions are honest and we're honest seekers of the truth. Men of God naturally often are full of questions. I'm full of questions. Some of them I will never resolve in my mind this side of Jordan. But that does not keep me, and it does not keep you, from having faith in the Lord, so that even when we don't understand all of the turns and the bends and the nooks and the crannies of the whys, we can still obey. Sadly, the enemies of God often ridicule Christianity, the concept of faith, as the lure of emotion leads them to a untenable conclusion, and they call our faith a blind faith or an unreasoned faith. Well, Scripture talks about faith, but it never talks about a blind faith, and it certainly never talks about an unreasoned faith. Christian faith must be able to stand against the questions that its critics and its believers both have. And we are justified in wanting to know what distinguishes our faith from the foolish and irrationality of other faith of which there is no logic. I'm going to be dealing primarily this evening from a very familiar passage or chapter. We won't get through the whole chapter. And that is Hebrews chapter 11. The writer of Hebrews was writing to people who were on the verge of quitting, leaving the faith. In Hebrews chapter 2, the first few verses, he warns them about drifting and going back to where they had been. In Hebrews chapter 10, just prior to chapter 11, he also gives them some stern encouragement, if not warning. He says in verse 35 of Hebrews chapter 10, "Cast not away therefore your confidence, which hath great recompense of reward." Paul's, or the writer of Hebrews, probably Paul, but we don't know for sure, the writer of Hebrews was concerned about the Hebrew brethren quitting. And he's saying, don't quit. So in verse 37, we have one very famous phrase, "For yet a little while, and he that shall come will come and will not tarry. Now the just shall live by faith, but if any man draw back, my soul shall have no pleasure in him." Live by faith is the admonition we have in that passage. Whatever faith is, it's to be a lifestyle and not simply an event nor a concept. He says, and he's quoting from Habakkuk chapter 2, the just shall live by faith. And in that statement, he's giving us that faith is a lifestyle, not just a concept. No, faith is a lifestyle. Not a concept that we visit, but a lifestyle we possess and we follow. Therefore, I think it's logical to deduce if we are not living by faith, it's because we're not righteous. Because that's how the righteous live. That's how the faithful live. Experiencing God in action. But that raises some questions. What is faith? And how does it work? If someone were to ask me or I were to ask you what is faith, we would probably initially, our minds, if not our words, would go to the first verse found in Hebrews chapter 11. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of the things not seen. And I find in that passage a very important concept that maybe just kind of goes under the radar when we think about that verse. Faith must have, or faith is of substance. It's not just stuff that's hoped for. It says, now faith is the substance. Faith is the stuff, if you will. Faith is not a willy-nilly concept in dreamland. Faith is being sure of stuff or something of substance, of God and salvation. Yes, it is our evidence of things not yet seen, but it is not an unsubstantial or unsubstantially based concept. Faith, therefore, deals with things that are real, even though we have not yet, with our physicality, seen them. It's based upon reliable substance. Therefore, faith is only as meaningful as the substance to which it is attached. It's the object of our faith that is the key. Having faith is not necessarily a virtue. The virtue comes from the object of our faith, and that's Jesus Christ. We could have faith in Buddha. We could have faith in Muhammad, and that would not be a virtuous faith from a spiritual standpoint, because the object of our faith would not have the virtue that Christ has. There can be bad faith if our faith is based on substance that is not true. And faith is not necessarily how you feel. I believe you can feel as if you have little faith and be very faithful. I think you can feel as if you have a lot of faith and really have no faith, because our feelings are so elusive. And faith is not first and foremost an emotion. The Christian life is a pilgrimage of faith. Our faith grows, it solidifies, but it begins with faith in our heart. As we embrace Christ and we trust in Him. Habakkuk had that sense, as I quoted earlier, when in the second chapter and the first four verses of that chapter, he talks about faith and has that famous phrase, the just shall live by faith, which is repeated three times in the New Testament. Romans chapter 1, verse 17, Galatians chapter 3, verse 11, and Hebrews chapter 10, verse 38, that I read for you. And it is a central motif. It is a critical theme in the writings of Paul. And it means that God is pleased when His people live by trusting Him. God told Habakkuk, I'll answer your questions, but I will not always answer them immediately. You are to live by faith. I said that faith is not guided necessarily by emotions. Emotions are like cargo in the back of a truck. They're appropriate, but you don't steer the truck by the cargo. You steer it by the steering wheel. We don't steer our faith by emotions. We steer it by the virtue of God. Because faith is tied to substance, which you must have. When I drop down to the sixth verse of chapter 11 in Hebrews, it says, but without faith it is impossible to please God, to please Him, For he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek them. Probably most of you could have quoted Hebrews 11:1 and 11:6. Or at least they're very familiar to you. Verse 6 says, we can't please God without faith. Now, why is that? Why must we have faith in order to please God? Well, one reason is that a lack of faith leads to disobedience. And obviously, that's not pleasing to God. But I think you're familiar with that one. I'd like to, for a moment, consider another reason it's impossible, I think, to please God without faith. Because if we don't have faith, we challenge and reject the integrity of God. A faithless person, a faithful day, a faithful act is a challenge, if not a rejection, to the integrity of God. In other words, to not live by faith is to call God a liar. To not live by faith is to call God a liar. When we leave faith, when we don't have our faith, we're saying, God, you don't know what you're talking about. At least our actions say that, because we don't do what he asks us to do. And why would I not do what God asked me to do if I thought he knew what he was talking about? And that leads to a very interesting concept, the difference between believing in God and believing God. I think a lot of people believe in God who don't believe God. We are to do both, and we'll talk a little bit more about that as I progress this evening. Now, we don't come out and say, God, you're a liar. I don't think anybody here would say that. And maybe even most people on the street wouldn't say that. But we can say that with our actions. We can say it. Faith is acting like God is telling the truth. And I don't mean that in the sense of hypocritical or fanciful acting. Christian faith causes us to act as if God is telling the truth. Now, we know God does tell the truth. As he can't lie. We're told that in Hebrews chapter 6. But faith is acting like God is telling the truth, not feeling God is telling the truth or saying that he is. Faith is an action. That's why in the Bible it repeatedly tells us to walk by faith. You don't find verses in the Bible that tell us to talk by faith or to think by faith. But consistently we are told to walk by faith. Why is that the phrase? Because faith is an action. Unless faith moves our feet, and that's really what James chapter 2, the latter part of it, is trying to tell us, when it says faith without works is dead. Unless faith moves our feet, it's not faith in the Christian sense. We cannot tell God, I have faith in you, and then it not move us to action. Now, we try it. Probably all of us on occasion do. But faith that doesn't move my feet isn't faith. And that's where and why I think most of the examples we see in Hebrews chapter 11 are all about. It's about people whose faith moved their feet. And we'll get to looking at them in more specifics, at least some of them. But the true issue, the true question of faith is, does God have integrity? Is what God tells us in his word true? Can we believe it? Not simply believe in God, but believe God. I believe I had a father, my dad, not the Father in heaven, but my dad. I believe I had a dad, but did I always believe him? No, I didn't always believe him. I had to learn some things the hard way and never did learn some of the things. Walking by faith, the just shall live by faith, is the concept of applying faith to every area of our life so that we're moving in sync with what he says. If I'm not moving in sync with what the Lord says, then that's not faith. because faith has to move my feet in sync with His Word. In the second verse of Hebrews chapter 11, it says, "For by it the elders obtained a good report," and it's leading us into this list of Old Testament characters that you're quite familiar with. It's through their faith and its movement of their feet in a faithful direction that these men and women got a good report. When we're not living by faith, sometimes we're cherry-picking by faith. Well, I like that, I like that. That's not what it's talking about. It's talking about a totally giving of ourselves to the Lord. Because the righteous live that way. Living our lives, calling God a liar every day because we refuse to live by faith or believe really what He says for us to do. It's what the heathens do. We are to walk in expectation and take God seriously. Last night I talked about being a serious Bible student. Maybe tonight I'm talking about being a serious faith walker. The third verse says, "Through faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that things which are seen were not made of things which were to appear." I want to spend the next few minutes, as long as time will allow me, and I'll stop when the clock says I should, looking at some of these pillars of faith and trying to digest what that means for us and what lessons. Yes, we get lessons that these are wonderful people of faith and we ought to be like these people, but why and how? Let me begin in verse 4 with the first one, Abel. "By faith, Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, by which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts, and by it being dead, yet speaketh." We're familiar with the two sacrifices of Cain and Abel. We're familiar with the results of that. We're familiar with the jealousy that came out of that that led to the murder in the fourth chapter of Genesis. But Abel teaches us what it is to worship by faith. Abel teaches us what it is to worship by faith. So the question that I have for myself, and I'm going to pose for you, are you a Cain worshiper or an Abel worshiper? Now, what's the difference between a Cain worshiper and an Abel worshiper? We don't sacrifice lambs. We don't bring corn or vegetables in here and burn them like Cain and Abel did. But there is a real difference. And I believe the difference is Abel's worship dealt with sin. How does God teach us He wants sin dealt with? He wants sin dealt with by the shedding of blood. Abel's sacrifice had the shedding of blood and Cain's didn't. Therefore, the difference between Abel worship and Cain worship is that Abel dealt with sin and Cain didn't. Now, I don't know how much they understood of that. They may have just been doing what God told them out of faith. But I believe that is a difference. So I ask myself, is my worship dealing with sin or not? Does my worship constitute a cleansing of my heart before the Lord, or does it constitute a covering up of sins rather than a washing away of sins? I don't believe you can worship God faithfully or pleasing to God without dealing with sin, because we need atonement. Even under the Mosaic law, they were taught the Day of Atonement. They needed atonement. You need atonement. All God's children need atonement. Maybe as a subsection of Abel worship is he brought of his first fruits. What lesson is there for me? Well, my worship cannot be leftovers. My worship should be my priority. Just throwing something together for our worship service, is that first fruits? Would Do you like to go to a restaurant that serves leftovers? Now, I happen to like leftovers. Sometimes leftovers are better than the first overs. But I don't want to go pay $9.95 for leftovers. And I don't think God wants leftovers either. Is our worship when we don't have something more important to do or something better to do? Well, what is more important than worshiping God? It's a pretty legitimate question. Junk food is very tempting, but it's not very nutritious, is it? If you've ever spent a day eating only junk food, you may pay for it the next day. If we just give God junk food on Sunday, don't expect to feel real good the rest of the week. Because we've not worshiped God with our first fruits. We don't worship by faith because we believe in God. We worship by faith because we believe God. Yes, I believe in God, but a lot of people believe in God who don't apparently believe God. It's that believing of God that leads us to follow His commandments. In Genesis chapter 4, verse 5, it talks about Cain's countenance falling. That's what happens when you don't worship God as He's asked us to do. The second person that we find, well, not the second, I'm going to skip Enoch for a little bit. In verse 7, it talks about Noah. By faith, Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, moved with fear, prepared an ark to the saving of his house, by which he condemned the world and became heir of righteousness, which is by faith. It's the reality of obedience that ignites faith and allows us to turn the invisible into the visible. As I said, faith is not grounded in feelings, but faith is measured by our foot traffic. It goes on in verse 7, as I read, to talk about Noah, who illustrated faith at work. What if Noah had only built half an ark? What if Noah had only built half an ark? Wouldn't have done him a lot of good. What if we only build half a life in serving God? 50% of our time is serving God. That sounds pretty good. But I think when the rain comes, half an ark, half a life, isn't going to do us a whole lot of good. Noah is a fascinating man because in Genesis chapter 6, verse 9, it says he walked with God, and that phrase, walked with God, is only ascribed to two people in the Bible. It's ascribed to Noah, and it's ascribed to Enoch, his ancestor. That's not the only people who walked with God, but that particular phrase, it's a unique one to Enoch and to Noah. Most want God to walk with them, but that's backwards. It's not God walking with us, it's us walking with God. I'm lost. Why would God want to walk with a lost person? He's not lost. That's who I want to walk with. And Noah's faith sustained him even when he had to walk alone. And he completed God's ark. You know, it talks about Noah preaching for some 100 years. I don't know all of what Noah said, but I know all I can find in the Bible is Noah had a 5-word sermon. It's going to rain. That was Noah's sermon. It's going to rain. A little self-incriminating, but their sermons don't have to be long, do they? Jonah's sermon was 3 words. And they were very effective, at least for Jonah. Another point I want to make about Noah before I leave it. In verse 7 it says, he prepared an ark to the saving of his house. What is the job of a godly man? It is to save his house. That's our job. Oh, we have other aspects of worship, but a Christian mother and father, their job is to save their house. Now, we can do everything right, and that may not happen, but that has to be our number one priority. Noah built that ark to save his family. And he was able to do that. Noah was convinced it was going to rain, and that affected his action. You know, if you know what's going to happen, you've got a chance, and most people maybe would take advantage of it. There used to be a TV show. It's not on anymore. I didn't watch it too often. It may be in reruns. It was called First Edition. Some of you may have watched that. And it was about a journalist who would get the headline for the next day, the day before. So he would always know a day in advance what was going to happen. He would know on today what was going to happen tomorrow. And the whole premise was he'd go and try to keep people from getting hurt because he knew what was going to happen. Obviously, that's a fictitious thing, but we know what's going to happen. Jesus is going to return, and he's going to separate the goats and the sheep, the wheat and the chaff. We know what's going to happen. We don't know when, but we know what's going to happen. So shouldn't that lead our conduct in an appropriate way? Well, let's move on down to another character or two. We come to Abraham. Verse 8, by faith Abraham, when he was called to go out of a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed, and he went out, not knowing whither he went. By faith he sojourned in a land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, and heirs with him of the same. For he looked for a city which hath foundation, whose builder and maker is God. If I were to diagram or dissect those three verses that I read, it's about Abraham, because of his faith, number one, leaving, number two, living, and number three, looking. Abraham left his country. He left a pagan culture. You know, sometimes you've got to leave something in order to grow up. I'll go a little further. I think all of us have to leave something in order to grow up. Sometimes we need to leave our parents, and that may or may not include geography. But if we don't grow up. Sometimes we have to leave our past. But we have to be willing to leave. When God came to Abraham, who is known as the father of the faithful, according to Romans chapter 4, verse 16, he spoke to him about the future, and he said, go from your country and from your kindred and your father's house to a land that I will show you. We don't really appreciate the kind of faith that took. But why did Abraham do that? Because he believed not only in God, he believed God. At the root of his faith was that he believed God, not just in God. It's about living every word that proceeds out of his mouth, according to Jesus in Matthew chapter 4, verse 4, that he quotes from Deuteronomy chapter 8, verse 3. Do you and I love the Lord enough to leave? Well, we don't have to leave Des Moines or wherever you live, but do we love him enough to leave worldliness? Do we love him enough to leave maybe friends that have not necessarily been a good influence on us? It goes on in verse 9 talking about Abraham living. He lived. He not only left, but he lived. God just doesn't want us to be overly attached here. And that's one of the real dangers of our prosperity. And then in verse 10 it says, he went looking for a city. He left, he lived, and he looked. What a wonderful transition. He left the world, he lived in an area of promise or an arena of promise, and he looked forward to the promise of heaven. I think that's a wonderful lesson for all of us. We'll go back to Abraham shortly, but we have a little interlude here in verses 11 and 12 about Abraham's wife, Sarah. Sarah, the one who laughed when God told her that she would have a child at a very, very advanced age that was beyond nature. Maybe too many times we settle for the ordinary when God has the extraordinary in store for us. We probably often either grossly overestimate ourselves or grossly underestimate ourselves. Very seldom do we get the pendulum where it belongs. But Sarah was barren. I don't care to know whether any of you have been barren physically or not. That's none of my business. But we can be barren spiritually, and that's even far more serious, isn't it? Don't let the power of your situation overpower the potential of your faith. Sarah continued or turned to a human way to try to make her barrenness go away. And you know how that worked out. It didn't work out very good, did it, with Hagar and Ishmael. Lesson: never go to the flesh to address and solve spiritual problems. You cannot solve spiritual problems with human solutions. It can't be done. They're two totally different realms. Not only did Sarah try to solve a, quote, spiritual problem with a human solution, don't we do that many times today? Here is usually the best place for many solutions, but we try human solutions. And they don't solve the spiritual problems. But even when we mess up, God doesn't give up on us. He didn't give up on Sarah. And here we find her in the Faith Hall of Fame, or the Hall of Faith, whatever you want to call it. The writer now goes back in verse 17 to Abraham again. By faith, when he was tried, he offered up Isaac. You remember that story from Genesis chapter 22. It is our life, not our lips. It is our walk, not our talk, that is evidence of our faith. Abraham could have said, well, sure, I'll offer Isaac, but we don't have that indication. His walk, his feet said, I will offer Isaac. Faith is measured by movement. If there's no movement, there's no faith, no matter how full of faith you and I feel. Tests in school, tests in life, are often to see what we have learned. Probably Abraham's greatest test was back here in Genesis chapter 22. And you know, that request of God really made no sense. And please don't take that I'm calling God a no-sense person, but let me explain. That test, to a human mind, made no sense. It didn't make any sense theologically, but it was because it was contrary to God's promise that he'd build a whole nation through Abraham. So it didn't make any sense theologically. It was a biblical contradiction, the request, because in Genesis chapter 9, it tells us not to take the blood of any man. So it contradicted, thou shalt not murder. And it was an emotional contradiction. Asking a father to kill his son, that's an emotional contradiction. Now, we know the story. Abraham didn't kill Isaac. But can you imagine the conversation he would have had with Sarah if he had? You what? You what? And yet, Abraham had faith that transcended the theological, the biblical, and the emotional to do what God asked him to do. Abraham was to obey without all the details. He didn't know how this was going to end. Hebrews does give us an indication that he had a sense that Isaac would be resurrected, but he didn't have all of the details. When you and I are called by true faith, we move, even in the midst of what appear to us to be contradictions. When it might not make sense to our humanness, Hebrews 11 says Abraham did it by faith. That's what faith can do when we don't operate by sight only. And Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 7, we walk by faith and not by sight. Well, I think Paul is saying we should walk by faith and not by sight, but I don't know that we always do that. If you only operate by what you can see, you will never see what faith can do. Because if I can see it, it's not of faith. If you only operate by what you can see, you will never see what faith can do, because you will only see what you can see, and what you see is all you can see, and you will never see what you can't see. I guess I could do that once more. If you only operate by what you can see, you'll never see what faith can do, because you will only see what you can see. And if what you see is all you see, you will never see all there is to be seen. I'm not going to do it again. What it means is, if I only do what I can see, I'm not going to walk by faith, which is going to keep me from ever seeing what is beyond what I can physically see. And isn't heaven beyond what I can physically see? Isn't the love of God beyond what I can physically see? If we only walk by sight, then we are really limited. Very limited. And spiritually, we're suicidal. Maybe one more. Moses, verse 23. By faith Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents, because they saw that he was an extraordinary or proper child, and they were not afraid of the king's command. I'm not going to read too much of that, because you're familiar with the story of Moses. And Moses had to make choices based upon faith. That's the lesson I get out of that. Moses made choices, and faith requires that we make choices. That's what verse 23 and following, at least that's what I get out of it. His parents made a choice of faith, putting him in the ark. That was a choice of faith. It is true, probably, that some people today don't have faith because their parents didn't have faith. That's why I have such great admiration for those who have faith, even though they weren't necessarily raised in a home full of faith. But if we don't pass our faith along to our children, we leave them at the mercy of our secular society. So Moses had to make decisions, and in verse 24 we see that at about the age of 40, he made a choice to try to help his people rather than remain in Pharaoh's court. I think what we're seeing is seeds that were planted very early in Moses' life by his parents. They may have taken 40 years, but they germinated. And now we see a godly man rising out of a pagan culture. Where else would Moses have gotten these seeds of faith were it not from his parents? He didn't get them from Pharaoh. I don't know how he would have got them in Pharaoh's court. And with that decision for Moses came some ill treatment, didn't it? A lifestyle was jeopardized. In verse 26, it says, he esteemed the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt. He put God first. Now that seed had to be planted in him very early in his life. But as he matured, and now he's about 40, he esteemed God more than he did living in Pharaoh's court, and it led to this decision. And he didn't know how this was going to end up. He probably thought, I'll just die doing Jethro's shepherding, because that's what he did till he was 80. Moses made his decision, and he was willing to bear the reproach. I always think of a young lady. She's not all that young now, but I don't know that she's quite 40. In northern Missouri, and she married a young Christian man, a member of the church. She wasn't raised in the church, and her parents had no affiliation. At that time, she was going to college. I won't even mention the college, because that might give you a clue who I'm talking about. Her parents were helping her with her tuition, had provided her a car, etc., etc. When she married this Christian boy, her parents quit all financial support and took back her car. I had a great amount of admiration for this young, she was probably about 22 when this occurred, young lady who put her Christian faith and Christian husband ahead of that. Maybe that's a minor thing to you. I thought it was a pretty major thing. It would have been had I been her age. Let us not lose God's recognition because we're looking for our culture's recognition. Let us not lose God's reward because we want the admiration of friends and family. That's nice, but it's not worth sacrificing. Because the culture will chew you up and spit you out. In verse 27 it says, by faith Moses forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. He put God ahead. Once again. And that's what Moses did because of his faith. This chapter goes on and talks about Rahab. There's a wonderful story there, a wonderful lesson. A lady who put God ahead of her countrymen. One of the questions, and I'll just say this very briefly, about Rahab is, didn't she lie? And did God approve of Rahab's lie? Well, no, I don't think God approves of lying. But Rahab had a hard choice, as I analyze it. She could either tell her countrymen where the spies went and therefore cause God's people to be killed, or she could protect them by hiding that from her countrymen. She chose to hide it from her countrymen, dare I say lie about it, because I think there was a greater good, and the greater good was the preservation of God's people. I can't say that I condone the lie, but I think she probably analyzed this and saw that there was a greater good. Now, please don't leave with John said you can lie. But there may be some ethical times in which lying in some form is justified. I can see in times of war, I can see in undercover law enforcement, that it might be an appropriate thing to do. I'm not sure I'd want to do it because I don't know that I'm quite sure enough of what I just said, but an undercover agent is somewhat lying. When we leave home, we leave the lights on as if to tell them someone's there when they're not. I guess that's a mild form of lying. I don't consider that sinful. But Rahab finds herself right here in the middle of the hall of faith. True faith only knows one way. And it gladly allows itself to be stripped of any makeshift substitutes. What we need badly are Christians. What we need badly is you and I who are prepared to trust God completely. Trust Him completely. Where health, wealth, friends, hiding places are stripped away if necessary, and we're left only to lean on God. To men and women of cheap verbal faith, that thought is absolutely terrifying. And I'll admit there are times in my life when that thought is rather terrifying. But I believe that to be true faith. Abraham didn't know where he was headed. Noah had no idea what rain was. It hadn't rained. They did these things and suffered ridicule. over and over. Why? Because of faith. C.S. Lewis once said, maybe the most frequently spoken word in heaven will be, oh. And what he meant by that is, in heaven we'll say, oh, now I understand. Oh, now I see what God's plan really was. Oh, I now see what the reason for some of the things I went through are. Well, we don't have that luxury in this life, do we? Because we can't see, as I think we will someday see. But isn't that where faith comes in? I often think of Job and all that he went through. Do you think Job enjoyed going through that? No. That would not be natural. Lose all of your kids, lose your home, your wealth. But if we could go up into heaven now and ask Job, are you glad you went through that? He'd probably say, not really. But he might also say, but I'm glad I did. Because in the latter part of the book of Job, now remember in chapter 1 of Job, Job is called a righteous man. In the latter part of the book of Job, Job utters a fantastic statement. He says, now I see God. Now he was a righteous man before this all started. But it was only after that that Job was able to say, now I see, really see God. I think he was a man of faith. If he hadn't been a man of faith, he would not have remained steadfast. He would have cursed God and probably died, but he didn't. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen, but it is a very substantial concept. But it must be a concept that moves our feet. That moves our feet. And without it, I think the Bible tells me it's not really faith. God doesn't ask us to do many of the things that he asked people in Hebrews 11 to do. Maybe that's a good thing, because I don't know if we'd do them.